9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
This is Barron's Live. Each week, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our weekly webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a market update with Barron's Deputy Editor Ben Levison and our guest Christopher Rossbach, co-founder and Chief Investment Officer of J. Stern. J. Stern is a private investment partnership based in London and Zurich with offices in New York. Chris manages the firm's World Stars Global Equity Fund. It's a concentrated portfolio of leading global companies domiciled in Luxembourg, and the strategy is now available to U.S. investors through a limited partnership fund. Chris and Ben, welcome to Barron's Live, and thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thanks, Lauren. Glad to be here.
Yep, thank you. Same here.
Glad to have you. So, Chris, I'll start with you. 2023 was a good year for the S&P. It returned about 19%. The MSCI World Index returned about 18%, but it was a great year for your World Stars Global Equity Fund, which was up almost 23%. So let's start by having you tell us a bit about your investment philosophy and what was behind that stellar gain.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren. It's great to be back. Our World Stars Global Equity Fund invests in a concentrated set of companies that have great quality and that can compound for the long term. So for us, quality is a gating condition. A company can be as cheap as it wants. If it doesn't fulfill our criteria for quality, we won't invest. And for us, quality is directly related to sustainability. We think that only companies that are sustainable in terms of how they go about their business can have sustainable competitive advantage and generate sustainable returns. And we think we're in a world where it's more about OPEX than CAPEX, more about intellectual capital than physical capital, and more about the cash flows that companies are generating than about the returns that they might be generating on some kind of tangible or intangible capital that is either in the process of getting disrupted or that's been created by some kind of transaction. So it's a very fundamental forward-looking approach that is looking to invest in companies in digital transformation, in consumer, and in healthcare, as you might expect, but also, and very importantly, in industrial companies where we see a lot of opportunities.
So NVIDIA is your top holding, and you are a big believer in the promise of AI. I imagine NVIDIA drove a lot of the performance last year. Tell us what's ahead in your view for NVIDIA and for the stock.
Yeah, so NVIDIA is our largest position. We bought it in February of 2022 when it started to sell off as part of the great rotation. And we bought more in November 2022 after the sell-off accelerated. So since then, it's been our strongest performer, and we continue to have great confidence in the stock. One thing is the strength of its competitive position. It is simply the leading player in providing the chips that you need in order to enable AI. But for us, it's really about the increase in computing capacity. It goes back to a world in which we had Cisco servers and Oracle databases and SAP and other enterprise resource planning software. And you have cycles where sometimes the applications and the software is ahead and the capacity is lagging, and sometimes it's the other way around. We're right now in a moment where the applications have run ahead. So the potential for AI to transform businesses, but the overall need for computing capacity, for the Internet of Things, for the metaverse, for all these drivers is enormous, and you need NVIDIA's chips.
So what kind of upside is left for the stock?
Well, for us, that's the key thing, because one thing is to find great companies that have great quality and that have great prospects in terms of the sales, the earnings, and the cash flows they can generate, but you have to be able to buy them at good valuations. And for us, that's really what stands out, is that NVIDIA throughout has been an extremely cheap company. It's because the results are increasing so much. And even though we were very positive about the last quarter, they exceeded even our expectations. If you look at where it's trading today, then on a simple price to earnings ratio, it's about 33 times 2024, going down to 27 times for 2025. That's on our numbers. And that is a very reasonable valuation for a company that has a growth trajectory ahead of it that we think goes to 5 or 10 years, which is also our investment horizon in terms of what we're looking for when we buy companies for the strategy. And so we think it's at an extremely reasonable valuation. And the third and fourth quarter of last year, when we had the sell-off related to the change in expectations about rates, it was obviously very much cheaper than that. So an extraordinary opportunity. But even with the performance that it's had, we still think it's a core position and at a very reasonable valuation.
So I want to stay on the theme of AI for a moment. You have written that given the significant cost involved in developing AI, it's important for companies to identify monetization opportunities quickly. I am curious, which companies do you think are doing the best job of monetizing AI right now?
Well, I think it's in the early adopters and in the software space. Again, it goes back to computing capacity. And so one, it's simply generating the capacity. So that's NVIDIA providing the chips, but for example, it's ASML providing the equipment to be able to make them with the huge investment that's taking place. Then it's about the companies and some of the industrial companies we might talk about that are enabling the actual production around that. Then it's around the software companies, and I would highlight Adobe, but also Salesforce that are the early adopters in terms of use cases. Adobe, for example, has trained a generative AI model on its own stock of images. And the AI fill button in its software suite is the most popular button in the whole program. So it's an extraordinary success for a direct use case for AI that is not encumbered by the copyright issues that we're seeing elsewhere. But then it carries on into consumer companies like LVMH or Nestle, that are driving innovation and are on the forefront of using it to engage their customers and to optimize their supply chains.
So you're an investor in Adobe. I'll stick with the A's. You're an investor in Amazon and in Alphabet, but you're not, it seems to me, a big investor in Apple. The stock has been notably unmagnificent this year among the Magnificent Seven, and I'm curious what your view is of Apple.
Yeah. I think what it really comes down to the fundamentals of valuation. I think the issue that we see with Apple, and I might add that we have a similar issue with Microsoft, another of the Magnificent Seven that has been a stronger performer, is that we think the valuations are very full. So if you think of the growth potential that Apple has as the world's leading consumer products company, it continues to be very strong. The replacement demand for their phones is massive, the integration that it offers and the customer experience. But it is in a phase where it is experiencing lower growth because there's only so much pricing that you can put through. And they're clearly trying to find other revenue streams that'll be more sustainable, recurring, and growth generative. But they're not finding them at the scale that they need, given that the market cap that the company has. So from our perspective, it's an absolutely leading company that's very important to follow and to understand. But from a valuation perspective, that has been recognized by investors, and it's now a very fully priced stock.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you mentioned industrials, and I'd like to talk about some of your industrial picks. Industrial stocks, of course, are benefiting from structural themes like reshoring, decarbonization, and automation. Eaton is one of your picks. How is the company capitalizing on these themes, and what does it mean for Eaton stock?
Yeah, so Eaton has been a position that we've held since 2015. So we're really very long-term investors in the company. It had a market cap of around 30 or 35 billion when we first bought it. It now has a market cap of close to 120 billion. And that is because they are one of the leaders in terms of being able to capitalize on all of these opportunities. And what I want to do is I want to go back to the beginning of what I said one of the key attributes of quality is, which it is about sustainability. And so for us, we're looking at sustainability, not just as a risk, but clearly, you know, companies are getting disrupted, but we want to be in the disruptors, not the ones that are getting disrupted. And so a lot of the industrial companies that we own are enablers of solutions to these huge problems that we're facing. That's things like climate change. It's the energy transition. It's the need to reduce carbon and to get to net zero over some kind of time frame. And that's both a commercial paradigm, as well in some places, especially in Europe, a paradigm that's related to regulation, because carbon pricing is a reality. And so even if you personally don't agree with it, it's something that's going to be impacting companies. So that's a really important element of it. For Eaton, they're one of the leaders in power management. It's power management for the grid as it gets renewed and as it gets adjusted for renewable energy, which is more complex. It's power management for data centers and warehouses, which are clearly one of the big drivers given digital transformation. But dare I say also for semiconductor fabs, which with the tens of billions of investment that are going into that, and power management for electrical vehicle charging, where they're a complementer and a supplier and an alternative to Tesla and to others. So they are in future oriented businesses where they're seeing tremendous growth. And in the most recent numbers that they reported, the backlog has grown to record levels. The stock is now trading on our numbers on about 28 times 2024, going down to 25 times for 2025. You might say that's a fairly full valuation for a capital goods company. But again, given the visibility of the backlog and the solutions that they're providing to this massive need for investment, we think it has a very strong trajectory ahead.
So I let you off the hook with Apple. I wanted to talk a little bit about Microsoft, which you put in the same bucket as being richly priced. Can you give us your take on Microsoft?
Well, on Microsoft, again, it's part of the set of ultra high quality companies. And so we clearly have to have a view on the ones we own, but also on the ones we don't. And so Microsoft, like Apple, I think has been recognized by markets as a company that has massive sustaining and recurring revenues. It's a theme that we've seen that goes back now 5 to 7 years. We in that space have invested in Adobe at a very early stage, recognizing that it was going to be about subscriptions and not about one-off licenses. Likewise, Salesforce is a business with recurring software revenues. But of course, Microsoft with the Windows and Office franchise is the ultimate recurring software company. And that, even though the growth has been more moderate, is something, again, that I think investors have recognized and have now really richly rewarded in terms of the share price performance, which has been strong, but so have others, but now also fully reflected, we think, in the valuation. One of the issues that we see with Microsoft is what they're doing with Teams, where it's a fact that they're bundling it for free as part of the Office suite of products. And so while in principle we're paying for it, it is fully integrated. And one of the issues that is taking place, certainly in our business, and I think many listeners will sympathize with that, is we have basically had to shut off a lot of the alternative providers of communication software, of video conferencing, and of other types of services because of the need to be compliant, to have recordings of these things and so forth. But it's a concentration that on the one hand, of course, is positive because you want to have strong market shares. But it is something that, again, goes so far that I think it could raise antitrust concerns.
Oh, that's
so. Yeah, go ahead.
Interesting. I hadn't quite thought of that. But increasingly, I am finding that people I speak to will only speak on Teams. No Zoom, no Google.
Exactly. Zoom, Swix, the list of applications is long. And it clearly is an issue, I think, around bundling and around the market power that they have. So, again, it doesn't take anything away from how well the company is doing and how well they're executing. But you have to offset this quality that they have with the risks to it. If I were Lina Khan, I certainly would know where I would be looking in terms of issues, and the valuation, which again has richly rewarded it, but we think is now very fully priced.
She thanks you for reminding her. All right, let's talk a bit about the macro backdrop. We've talked a lot about stocks, but there's a lot of macro this week. Fed Chair Jay Powell is testifying before Congress Wednesday and Thursday. President Biden will deliver the State of the Union address on Thursday night. Friday morning, we'll get the release of the February jobs data. So a macro hound could not ask for more. Ben, I'm going to bring you in and ask you, is Powell going to get a tough grilling on Capitol Hill?
Well, almost certainly. We know that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren hasn't been happy with Fed policy. You know, she thinks it's too restrictive. And Feldstrat was pointing this out in a note this morning that, you know, that she's going to be pushing for rate cuts. But everything that we've seen from the Fed so far, and really everything we've seen from the economic data, suggests that, you know, March is not going to happen. May is probably not going to happen. The market is looking to June for the first cuts. But I think that if the data keeps holding up the way it has, that June might even be premature. But I don't think, you know, I think you'll see Powell do what he's done quite a bit recently, which is just say that he's data dependent. He wants to see, you know, inflation continue to come down, and that he's not there. You know, he has not made up his mind about any of this yet. And that might not sit well with some people in the Senate or in Congress, but, you know, that's what they're going to have to deal with. For investors, I mean, I would hope none of that is a surprise. If anyone's expecting Powell to come in and be quite dovish, I'd really wonder where they've been for the past couple months.
And Powell is not one for surprises himself.
No, he's been very clear about what he what he's looking for, what he wants to see, and where interest rates could go.
So the jobs report is coming Friday, as I mentioned. January was a very messy month data-wise. We had surprisingly strong payroll growth. Wage gains were high. A lot of things happened at the beginning of the year that could skew the numbers. People are expecting February to show more normalization. Where do you think things will land for February in terms of both payroll growth and wage gains?
Yeah, I mean, the expectation is for about 200,000 new jobs created, which would be down from, as you said, this really wild January number of 353,000. And as you said, there's a lot that happens in January that can throw these numbers off. Again, there's also a lot of just a very wide range of expectations here. Andrew Brenner was pointing this out. He was showing, said that, you know, on the high end, you have 260,000. On the low end, you have about 130,000. And the thing that's probably going to be most important to watch, though, is going to be the average hourly earnings. They were up a lot again in January. They're up 0.6%. But there was, you know, that was partially because the hours worked dropped. The work rate had dropped because of the bad weather in January. And with February weather being better, that should be better. But 22V, which is a great research firm, is pointing out that it's not just going to be that. I mean, this number will almost certainly come down. But what has to happen is you want to see that number go down as much as the work week returns to normal, goes up, because they move in opposite directions with each other. So if the work week normalizes, but the average hourly earnings doesn't go down as much as that would imply, then you could have a problem. They do say that if you get a benign report, you know, if it comes in and it's not, you know, it's pretty much around the consensus or a little bit weaker, you know, it'd be set the stage for a recovery in value stocks, which would benefit from a strong economy. But if it's too strong and that, you know, would apply, higher rates and whatnot, growth could do better then.
You can be sure Jay Powell would be watching the report carefully.
Very.
So, Chris, you are a fundamental investor, but you do pay attention to macro trends. And I'm curious what your interest rate outlook is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's clearly been a very macro-driven environment now that interest rates have normalized for the first time since the global financial crisis. But I think one of the things we have to recognize is that Goldilocks in the economy and from markets is never just right. In the fairy tale, it is. But in markets, it's always either too hot or too cold. And the way that the trajectory of markets goes is that it then plows a course through the middle, and it often climbs a wall of worry. So I think that's a basic fact that I certainly believe in very strongly. But I also think that the way that Sinatra said it, the record shows we took the blows. We've taken the blows on inflation. We've taken the blows on rates. And we've taken the blows on valuations. And what happened last year in the third and fourth quarter, I think, is something very positive about rates, which is that the markets have taken over. Until then, I think it was really driven by Powell and by the statements from the Fed. But what you saw in the second half of last year is that the 10-year went from 4 all the way up to 5%. I think we can now say that it overshot. And it then went all the way back down again. Those are massive moves that have also had an impact on markets. And now with the 10-year at 4.2% roughly, it seems to me that we're in a moment where markets are setting the rates. It's one of the reasons why Powell was talking about cutting rates on the short end to bring them in line with that. But I think that this 4% is a rate of interest rates that is completely compatible with a resilient underlying economy, with a strong growth strong jobs market that is also moderating, with inflation that is moderating. And so I think we're in a moment where the market has actually been efficient for now, but it certainly is setting those rates. And in terms of outlook, it will be data dependent. We had a situation where as recently as a couple of years ago, we thought that Powell and the Fed were completely out of options to set policy. And now they're back to having the full set of them. So I have a great deal of confidence that the strength of the underlying economy is going to carry on, and that Powell will have a lot of leeway in terms of deciding when is the time to potentially cut rates and to bring them in line with the long term.
We had a question from Vaquero, who wants to know how many interest rate cuts you expect this year, or do you think it is too soon to tell?
Well, I think, well, we're really fundamental investors. So for us, it's about a 5 to 10 year view, and it's about what the underlying fundamentals of the economy are doing. So I don't really think in terms of numbers of rate cuts. Powell has said there's going to be 3 that could happen. We cautioned at the beginning of last year saying that there could be significant volatility if it turns out that there wouldn't be a significant rate cuts, and that's what happened. And I think there's a similar possibility this year. So I do think that as we go into the second half and as potentially growth moderates, that there's going to be scope for rate cuts. But I certainly don't expect them before the beginning for the first half of this year, data dependent. And I think that when they happen, I think that 3 might be the right number, but I think we'll have to wait and see.
All right. I just want to say as an aside, it's the first time someone's quoted Frank Sinatra on Barron's Live. Next time we'll ask you to sing it. So I want to move on to corporate earnings. We are at the tail end of earnings season. And Ben, you follow the earnings trajectory very closely. Do you have any last takeaways about this season, that being the fourth quarter?
It's been strong. I think it's been surprisingly strong. It started off, not great, but the numbers have really come in quite well. It looks like we're going to come in around, someplace around 218 for all of 2023, and the numbers were pretty good. I think it looks like the estimates will be around $54 or we'll hit about $54 for the fourth quarter. If you want to take a negative view on it, it's that, you've had, double beats. The rate there has been far lower than normally it is. So those are companies that beat on both earnings and sales, but actually hasn't mattered all that much this time around. The drops when companies have missed on either sales or earnings but beat on the other have actually been smaller than historically. I think that just goes to show that, the investors are pretty optimistic about the market. Estimates for the first quarter of 2024 have slipped a bit. They've come down about 54.73 as of the beginning of March. That was down from 56.03 at the end of 2023. But that's fairly typical. And you're still seeing that earnings estimates for the full year, they're down a little bit as well to about 242 and change, but that's still going to be an 11% rise this year. So earnings generally are holding up pretty well. And as long as they do, this market should actually be okay.
11% is not chopped liver, as they say.
Not at all.
That's quite a good gain. So tell us about Broadcom. The company is reporting Thursday. It's had a spectacular 12 months, up more than 120%. What's the outlook there?
Well, it's funny because, you know, it's gotten caught up in all this the hype over AI. And I'd love to hear Chris's thoughts here. But it has this AI business, so it's probably going to do quite well. But it also has a traditional networking business that is likely to be weaker. Broadcom has been, you know, saying that they actually have been giving hints that they might be better off than, say, an Arista, Cisco, or Juniper right now. But I think that is going to be the key, is where our investors going to focus on this AI or on this traditional business, and can the AI deliver enough to sort of offset weakness elsewhere? I always worry when I see a stock go up that much. It's up 50% in the last 3 months, so since the last earnings report. And you know, sales are expected to be up quite a bit. It'll be almost 12 billion, and that'd be up from 8.9 billion. But earnings are up about, you know, to about $10.40 from $10.33. So, you know, I always get worried when I see these kind of big gains heading into an earnings report. So I'd be a little bit cautious.
You know, we had a question from Duane. I'm going to pose it to you, Chris. Can you discuss some stocks or subsectors within technology that aren't part of the Magnificent Seven that you would recommend? Broadcom being not part of the Magnificent Seven, you did mention Adobe.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that I think we have to be very careful. I think in particular on the CapEx side of tech, which for us, which is clearly largely the semiconductor side. I think one really has to be very, very selective. One of the reasons why we haven't been investing in semiconductors for many years since we started the strategy in 2012 is because so much of it is commodified and it's subject to a great deal of cyclicality. So it's something that I think we have to be very cautious about because parts of the commodified semiconductor industry, and particularly the ones related to autos, for example, but also normal semiconductors that go into industrial applications are really cyclical, and the competition can be very distorted. So that's why I think one has to be really selective. In terms of the Magnificent Seven, we own the ones that we've talked about, in particular the NVIDIA, but also the platforms, as you said, Alphabet and Amazon, and we also like Meta as a business. So those are the key ones. Other stocks that we like are ASML, as I said. That's a European company that is one of the market, well, it's the market leader in lithography equipment for semiconductors. We think it has an exceptionally strong outlook. It has performed very well since we bought it in January of last year. It's a $370 billion market cap company. That's trading at about 30 times 2025, which we think is exceptionally well positioned. If you just think of all the tens of billions of investment that are going into Arizona, they're going into Germany, they're going into Japan. And dare I say, TSMC has announced at the end of last year, $30 billion that are going into Taiwan. And I do think that TSMC management knows a bit more about China-Taiwan relations than most of us. In terms of where they're putting their dollars. So ASML is one that we like a lot. Another business that we like on the software side is, as I said, we talked about Adobe a bit in terms of the recurring revenues that they have and them being positioned as a beneficiary from AI. They had softer numbers on difficult comparisons that have taken place, but we think that just offers an opportunity. And it's a stock that has derated from multiples of 35 to 40 times back to 30, going down to 27 times 2025. So we think an exceptional opportunity to buy a company with recurring revenues. And then those are some of the key tech investments that we have.
Okay, great. Going back to earnings, I just wanted to pick up one more name with Ben, and that's Target. The company reports on Tuesday. Its stock is up about 6.5% over the past 12 months. What is the outlook for Target?
Yeah, Target, this has been just such a tough stock. It's had was great during the pandemic and has just fallen apart. It got basically everything wrong in terms of what its shoppers would want once things started to normalize. But it has started bouncing back. It's up about 15% over the last 3 months. JP Morgan is pretty optimistic about this quarter's earnings. They actually think that it's going to be able to report a profit of around $2.66 a share, which would be quite a bit above the consensus, which is around $2.41 right now. And they see that happening with better margins, and a lot of the margins improvement coming from what they call a reduction in shrink, which is just the jargon for less shoplifting going on. You know, that's been a huge problem for all these stores. But they also say that it's really going to be about the outlook for the year and how conservative they are in offering that outlook. If they can talk about their margins getting back to 6% or more, perhaps even up to 7%, then that would be, I think, really good for the stock. But it really needs to try to hit those numbers. But it is still, it's been beaten down a lot. And so I think that there's a good chance that if it provides these things, there's some upside there.
So we call Target Target.
Yeah.
And now let's switch to the luxury side of the aisle, the true luxury side, and that's LVMH. I know that's a stock you own, Chris. It's a stock that you recently bought more of after it was knocked down over China worries. What's the upside potential?
So LVMH is the undisputed global leader in luxury. If you look at our portfolio, then a lot of the tech companies and the industrial companies are companies that are based in the States. And that makes up for about 65% of the companies that we own. But a lot of the consumer companies, including LVMH, are based in Europe. So some of those things we simply think are just done better by the leaders that are based in Europe. So LVMH has a tremendous potential, we think. It's been a very strong performer. It has an unrivaled position in terms of the actual Louis Vuitton brand, which it continues to be able to innovate and to execute with tremendous scale and innovation. So they really have the flywheels going. And one of the things they did in the pandemic in China, when everything shut down, is they sent care packages with some small gifts and with food to their largest customers. So can you imagine a company treating you like that? They can do that. They were flying in their handbags from all over the world to markets where they were selling them to keep them in stock. Can you imagine a company that is able
Nothing like
that?
Keeping your name in front of customers.
Indeed. At the same time, they're innovators in AI. So we've seen the avatars that they've created. I think they're not totally unlike what Mark Zuckerberg showed us. So it's early days in terms of looking at your sort of high fashion avatar. That's still work in progress, but they're working on it very hard. So we think there's tremendous opportunities. It's been clearly all these companies have been held back by the impact that the rising rates have had on consumer spending and by the, in some cases, difficult comparisons from the revenge spending that took place right after the reopening that is now annualizing. But again, I think it's something that has offered up a tremendous opportunity. If you look at LVMH now, it's a market cap of about $460 billion. It's trading at a multiple of 26 times 2024, going down to 24 times, like in line with a lot of the consumer companies that we think are great opportunities. That's 10 or even 20% around the long-term averages. And so we look at fundamental value based on levered free cash flows, but there's the reality of where companies trade from a PE basis. And so I think you have a tremendous opportunity right now to pick up a global leader at a discounted valuation.
It's rare that you get that sort of opportunity with LVMH.
It is. And I mean, I'm very much with, you know, with Warren Buffett and with Charlie Munger in terms of saying normally what we should be doing is we should be buying great companies at good prices. But with the annual meeting of Berkshire coming up, I think you occasionally have opportunities to buy great companies at great prices. And so, you know, in the third and fourth quarter of last year, you definitely had an opportunity to buy these big tech companies, including the ones from the Magnificent Seven that we like, at very low valuation. So that was an opportunity that came and it went. And they're still at good values, but perhaps no longer at absolutely great ones, given how well they've performed. But a company like LVMH is now a great value company.
I know you wanted to talk about Nestle as well, which you consider a wonderful value. So maybe we can spend a minute on that and then take a couple of questions.
Absolutely. That'd be great. Yeah. So Nestle has been a company that I've been invested in throughout my entire investment career. The Stern family that is backing our business has been invested in it since the 1950s. So it's true long-term investing. And I'm now on my roughly sixth or seventh CFO and my third CEO at Nestle in terms of the institutional knowledge that we have about the business. It's the world's leading food company. It has leading positions in categories like pet care and coffee and some others. It can generate businesses like Alcon, which we own, the world leader in eye care, eye implants for the cataract surgery we're sadly all going to have at some point. And it's an interesting healthcare opportunity. But they've built Nespresso, which they, if they spun it off and nobody tell Bill Ackman or Dan Loeb or somebody about that idea, but I hope they'll keep it. But it would be a business that would be worth tens of billions. And they've built it through investment over time. So they can innovate. They have the scale. They are now, but they have been derated. They reported numbers that were a bit lighter than street expectations in the last quarter. They still delivered growth of 5.7% in Q4 last year. They've gone back to real growth, which is a positive given this squeeze on consumers that you've seen in the US and in Europe. Again, pet care and the coffee have been growing very strongly at more high single digits. They've guided for 4% organic growth for this year, which we think is positive. And they have a lot of turnaround potential in terms of the underlying growth, the reinvestment, the fact that some of that low growth is because they've been proactively culling SKUs and they're coming to the end of that. That's something the market doesn't like because it likes easy comps. That's one of the drivers going forward. And they're seeing opportunities in GLP-1. In terms of nutritional products that can support people who are on it. And that's clearly one of the other major phenomenons that we're seeing. So it's very well positioned. And the stock is now trading on 19 times 2024, going down to 17 times for 2025. That's a solid 20 to 30% below where it's usually trading. And so if you're looking for valuation opportunities now, then I think companies like LVMH, but Nestle, offer a tremendous opportunity.
There's a lot of levers Nestle can pull there.
Indeed.
So good situation. All right, we had a question from Marina. A bunch of us are wondering the same. Is this a good time to invest in Japanese ETFs? And perhaps you can use the question to talk more broadly about the Japanese market.
Yeah, so Japan is a massive economy, and we would obviously always choose to invest in companies. And I think you can benefit from what is going on in Japan, which I think is very positive, clearly by buying a Japanese ETF that would give you exposure to the highest market cap companies. You could buy some of the leading companies there. We look at them, we compare them to the ones we have. And so far, we've decided that we prefer the ones we have. There's a company like Shiseido, one of the leading cosmetics companies. We prefer L'Oreal. There's Fanuc, a robotics company. We prefer Honeywell or Amphenol. There are great companies there. I think what is going on there fundamentally is very positive because they are now, they're really the canary in the coal mine in terms of an economy that had slow growth, that had deflation, and that has had a shrinking population. Even Japan has now gotten to the point where they have undercapacity. And that's a huge theme, I think, across investing. It's true in the US that we don't have enough capacity for the demand that we see. That's why we have inflation. It's true in Europe, where the dynamic is different, but there is undercapacity in tight labor markets. And it is particularly true in Japan, where it is finally turning around. And so you're seeing that there's a huge amount of investment that is necessary in order to offset the population decline. And that investment is going to be positive for productivity, for GDP, for wages, and for growth. And so that's, and for inflation, I should add. So this is a huge turnaround that is taking place there. It's making companies that are operating in Japan more optimistic. It's making many of the companies we talk to that do business in Japan and that have stuck with it optimistic. And I'm going myself there in a couple of weeks for an investor day of Sika, a Swiss company that's a leader in construction additives and in waterproof membranes, so industrial demand, and they've been building their footprint there. And it's making investors positive. So I do think there is a great opportunity, and you can pick the way that you invest in it, whether it's through, again, ETFs to get the market itself, through companies, or through companies that are based elsewhere, but that are benefiting from what's going on.
Sounds like a great opportunity. I have to say the U.S. markets closed at an all-time high on Friday, but both you and Ben have pointed out that there are so many opportunities still to be tapped. Just because the index is at an all-time high does not mean that all stocks are.
Yeah, so, and if I may add, sorry, Lauren, if I may, just to quickly say, one of the things we've been seeing in the third and fourth quarter and in the first quarter of this year is a broadening. So it's no longer just about big tech. We're seeing a lot of other businesses that are now delivering, and they're delivering in terms of their operations, but they're also delivering in terms of their share prices.
And Lauren, I think one of the interesting things today was seeing the equal weighted S&P, I think, was trading at what would be a new all-time high as well, which is a sign of that broadening.
Which is a very healthy thing for the bull market.
Yeah. So glad, especially given that there's cheap stocks. So.
Yes. Glad you pointed that out. I am sorry that that's all the time we have today. We are getting wonderful questions. I wish we had time to deal with them. So, Chris, we will have to have you back. And Ben,
thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Ben, we will have you back next Monday. You and I will be taking a closer look at what's moving in the markets, and perhaps we will scope out what's ahead for the second quarter. I'm looking forward to that, and I hope our listeners will join us. Also, please join us tomorrow at noon for a virtual live event, Barron's Roundtable, Tapping into the Senior Economy. I'll be moderating a panel with two healthcare investment specialists, and my colleague Reshma Kapadia will be speaking with Ken Dichtwald, founder of AgeWave, and Carolyn McClanahan, founder of Life Planning Partners. You can register at events.barons.com, and the link is in the chat. We hope you will join us for that tomorrow as well. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. Stay well and have a good week.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.